We present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jell.
And welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the St. Peter's and St. Andrew's Parish magazine, read by Cathy Clugston.
Join us on the second and fourth Sundays of the month for breakfast, including hot sausages aimed at children under 10 years old.
Our thanks to Ben Harris for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Angela Barnes and political columnist for the Daily Mail, Peter Oborn. And opposite them, on my left, Lloyd Langford and Lucy Porter. Angela, who's been struggling to move a cabinet around?
This is Theresa May's excellent attempt at showing us just how strong she is. She's decided to have a reshuffle, and just like, you know, the general election of last year and the Tory party conference of last year, it has backfired more than a 1976 Cortina. The reshuffle has been interesting. She's sort of like a parent. If you're trying to get your kids ready for school and they won't budge. That's what Justine Greening and Jeremy Hunt have done this week, isn't it? It's like they're all in the car, but Jeremy Hunt just won't put his bloody shoes on. That's where the... I mean, how you could be in a position where the NHS is suffering the worst winter crisis that it has in years, and you can't sack your health minister because he's decided that with the tide of absolute bile coming towards him, the best thing to do is to stand and face it.
He's always like this on the News Quiz. He's sort of little rants against, they're sort of lefty rants against.
I haven't started yet, Peter, don't you worry.
Yeah, but we normally balance it out with one fascist, Peter. Welcome to the show.
That's a sort of low-level political insult.
We call it the Evans chair.
I'm sort of impressed with Jeremy Hunt staying where he is because, I mean, he's got the negotiating skills of people who work in Sky Broadband call centres. You know, because I tried to leave Sky Broadband this week, and let me tell you, he's ended up with a social care portfolio. I've ended up with Sky Sports Plus.
So having sneered at Tory cabinet ministers, she's now sneering at people who work in call centres. We're learning a lot about the News Quiz.
Well, it's equal opportunities abuse, yep. Peter. I mean, I'm wondering if you've got any opinions on this.
I think that the government is working well. It's got a sense of confidence. I think that staying in a job is quite a good thing. The longer they're in it, the better they get at it. Mr. Hunt is just about to become the longest-serving health secretary of all time. I think that it's working quite well. Where things go wrong, they apologise.
I'm sorry, I can't say anything because I'm an ex-nurse and I've literally just bitten my tongue off.
Yeah, what's lovely is how beloved he is by the medical profession. I mean, it really is. The longer he stays in post, the more they learn to love him. It's
every time Jeremy Hunt's on my TV wearing that NHS pin badge he's got, I feel the same way about him as I do as when you see like a teenager in a Ramones T-shirt. And it's like, it's not for you, mate.
What do you feel, Peter, about, say, for instance, her suggesting to people that they should resign or move and them saying no?
Actually, what she did was sit down with Mr. Hunt, work it through, and listen to people. I was very impressed in many ways. Hunt's very committed as a health secretary. He made the case that there is a crisis. I'm not going to run away from it. I'm actually going to confront it. That's moral spirit, pluck.
Moral spirit doesn't get operations done, though, does it? That's the problem.
It's not a total shuffle, is it? It's a bit like when you've sort of someone's half shuffled a pack of cards. You go, hang on a minute, they're all coming down the same way that they did the last game. It's almost as if we've discovered a thing that she can't do. But some people, still Boris Johnson, Philip Hammond, David Davis, they've all stayed in place.
The excellent Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, remains in place. But they've brought in some excellent new people, new talent.
Who are the exciting newbies, Peter?
Well, we've got... such a galaxy of it. I was wondering which one to highlight. You look at the brilliant new Whip's office full of young women who were very, very good at their job. I know that, I mean, this is the BBC. You don't like women, you don't pay them, but... when I talked about women. And actually, the Conservative government, they like women, they promote them.
The way that Damien Green likes women, that's not...
But the problem with reshuffles as well is that particularly this one, it wasn't exciting. And the correspondents always try and make it sound exciting. They described this one as the massacre of the middle-aged men. That was what the Daily Mail called it, which is, for a start, it's not, you know, if you want to massacre middle-aged men, don't do it in a cabinet reshuffle. You just poison the barrels at a real ale festival.
To the idea of a metaphor. It's quite a complex idea, obviously, beyond
you. I know,
you.
But then they've ended up... What? There are no more women in the cabinet than there were before. Surely a massacre involves a bit of thinning out.
I think there's a lot to be said for middle-aged men. And I'm one myself, and I think we have something to contribute. A bit of experience, being knocked around a bit, and a bit of gravitas.
Self-awareness, that's another one. It's all there, there's a lot of...
There's a lot in the locker.
When she's reshuffling, is she in a position where she has to worry about the consequences of their sacking, if they're going to turn on her the minute they're at the door number 10?
Yes. This week, we had Justin Greening. And she, having been sacked, she promptly went and sat next to Dominic Grieve on the disloyal bench.
Is that like the Tory version of the naughty step?
Very like that.
There's that strange thing as well, though. She was, like, I suppose everyone, when they resign, then they get sort of people banging on their sort of doorstep and stuff, and so she had to go through that sort of gauntlet of being hassled while she was, you know, in her running gear in the morning. And you think that's a sort of new element of politics, I suppose, that bit. You didn't used to have, I don't know, sort of Harold Wilson being hassled on his way to Zumba and that sort of thing. This is Theresa May's reshuffle, essentially a game of musical chairs where everyone dances awkwardly around the cabinet table and then dives for a chair the moment the Prime Minister stops screaming. Justin Greening has left the cabinet after her air of quiet competence meant she simply didn't fit in with the rest of the team. Greening turned down the chance to take over work and pensions and be responsible for the implementation of universal credit, once again showing a level of intelligence the government can ill afford to lose.
Scripts for you? Do they all work for Jeremy Corbyn's momentum? I mean, this isn't just sort of centre-left. This is far-left stuff, your scriptwriters. Right. Or do you write them yourself?
Does it frighten you? Or...
I don't think this is meant to be a balanced show.
Well, that's... Well, go writer. Jeremy Hunt stayed on as Secretary of State for Health despite speculation that he might be moved on. His repeated use of the phrase, a captain does not abandon his ship, confounded his critics by revealing that he's not simply rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, but fully believes himself to be at the helm, joyfully ringing on the ship's bell as he blithely steers it into the remorseless jaws of oblivion. We ended up pretty much exactly where we were, with a lot of utterly interchangeable middle-aged white men. And Gavin Williamson turned to Dominic Raab, and Dominic Raab turned to Gavin Williamson, and neither of them could tell which was which. There have been a few changes. Matt Hancock moves to culture, Karen Bradley moves to Northern Ireland, and new Minister of State for Business and Energy is former Liverpool midfielder Philip Coutinho, a snip at £140 million. Jeremy Corbyn also took the opportunity to have a cabinet reshuffle. His jam thermometer now lives next to the whisks, and he gallons... and the gallons of dreary beans are next to the peculiar vegan ham. 2 points to Angela. Lloyd, have a listen to this. I'm a soldier of love. Well, Lloyd, you appear to be wearing less than you were when that song started. No one is blaming you.
I've genuinely at home got a calendar of Lloyd with his top off on pretty much every page. Yeah.
Really?
I'll send you a copy.
Are these
you...
commercially available, or is it a bespoke? Was it a gift
it
from
a
Lloyd?
In
a moment of confidence?
It was a threat.
What? This sounds extraordinary.
We did a tour together in New Zealand and we made a calendar of the tour, topless cap. But I was the only woman on the tour. So I had to hide behind a shower cubicle for my pay. I don't know why I've gone down this road. I'm really regretting it.
Well, I mean, if it helps to talk about it.
It's a consensually made calendar.
Lloyd, when we were sharing a venue together in Edinburgh.
Oh, crap.
In my show, for reasons we won't go into, I had a carrot costume, which I wore over clothes, and Lloyd asked if he could try it on one day, and he wore it naked.
And I did a show in it, and I walked out, and I didn't realise it would sway.
Because you were going, that was your costume for. I remember going to see a show and you were wearing a banana costume, Lloyd.
Yeah.
This obsession with food-based and... costumery. No, well, anyway, it's good to see you bouncing back and out the other side. Anyway, we have veered very slightly off topic. Lloyd, which advertising campaign might have tanked?
This is a new campaign for the British Army, and it's a sort of different tack from previous campaigns such as Be the Best and What Goes on a Tour of Afghanistan Stays on a Tour of Afghanistan. It's a £1.6 million campaign, and the adverts ask various questions such as, can I be gay in the army? Can I practice my faith? Do I have to be a superhero? What if I get emotional? There's a big focus on emotional support, which sort of baffled me, because joining the army for emotional support makes about as much sense to me as becoming a postman to avoid little red elastic bands. It feels like trickery somehow, because I preferred the old style of army adverts where you were being shouted at by a man with a moustache with mud all over his face, carrying a big gun, and you were told to apply if you felt any kind of arousal. No, I'm not an expert on the army, no.
So you don't know what you're talking about at all?
Do you know what you're talking about?
No, I think the British Army is one of the best in the world, if not the best. It's always had scope for moral refreshment and always on the side of...
So you, every now and then you think it's needed to be refreshed morally?
Not at all. I don't think it needs it, but I think it's simply emphasising that the image of it as being purely stiff upper lip is not a bad idea.
Story like this means that sort of lots of sort of army people come on the radio and then have to sort of talk about the army. For instance, Major General Tim Cross, he said that the whole point of the army, the soldiers must be able to duff up the Queen's enemies. And I suddenly started sort of panicking on behalf of people like Fergie and thinking, oh my God, that's, you know.
I think that the army, they kind of needed a new angle since the popularity of Tough Mudder. Which is kind of like joining the army, but with less chance of breaking the Geneva Convention. If you do break the Geneva Convention during Tough Mudder, then you definitely won't get a certificate.
I like the idea that the modern army is like, drop and give me 20 adjectives to describe the way you're feeling.
This is the new recruitment drive for the British Army, which consists of adverts asking questions like, can I be gay in the army, and do I have to be a superhero? Critics say this will not appeal to the sort of people most likely to sign up, and that they should instead be asking questions like, how good are you at fighting, and do you really like the sound of getting pissed in Aldershot? One advert asks, what if I get emotional? A simple answer to that one, like all cowards, you'll be shot. General Sir Nick Carter has defended the campaign and says the Army's aims remain combat skills and fighting power. And since the emergence of Jeremy Corbyn, they've also added preparing for a coup. The Army Jobs Twitter account tweeted, we don't see skin colour, gender or religion in the Army. Continuing, you're literally all just cannon fodder. The new adverts make it clear to potential recruits that it's OK to be emotional, gay and religious, just not at the same time. It's the army, not the Vatican. Two points to Lloyd. Peter, which duo are as charming as they are offensive?
I think you may be talking about David Davis, the Brexit secretary, Phil Hammond, the Chancellor of Exchequer, going to Europe in order to sell Brexit. I think, actually, the idea of Phil Hammond charming anybody, it is the emphasis, you're on the offensive, I think, and this could take more than charm. If I was wanting to charm Europe, I'd keep Phil Hammond well away from all
You're more of a Davies man, are you? Do you think he's, Davies, got the, he's got the interpersonal skills?
He's more... Yes, I'd say that he's quite distinguished. He's former foreign minister. knows Europe like the back of his hand. He's all right.
And you... But they're not going together, are they? They're on separate missions. It might sound like the two of them together, but they've gone to set. They've split them up like they've been naughty in class or whatever. He's had to go one way, he's had to go the other.
Like maximising, you know, obviously you're deploying your assets in the most effective way is what you're doing there. Not two of those. You know, you're spreading them about.
No, it's no.
Good,
it's,
you know, good good thinking. That yes.
It's not military what they're doing. Right? They're not a sort of advanced party.
I disagree. I think David Davis looks like a man who would unscrupulously sell you a Nana conservatory. I think Michelle Barnier's worried about doing any kind of deal and then ended up with a gazebo he didn't want.
It's like every relationship I've ever had, really, where you start off making loads of demands and end up just whimpering and asking for anything, any crumbs of comfort.
It does have that sort of slight relationship feel to it. It's sort of, you know, people said, oh, it's a bit like, you know, well, they've dumped each other or whatever. It's more or less, well, Britain's asked for an open relationship and now Europe's changed the locks and Britain's basically in the garden in its pants. screaming about closure.
More of that sane and balanced BBC approach to Brexit.
Yeah. Well, as long as you get 1,500 well-paid words out of it, Peter, I'm sure it's all going to be worth
Brexit.
It.
Brexit fatigued. I feel like Brexit is a bit like being flashed at by a stranger. Like, I no longer care if it's hard or soft. I just want it to go away.
I agree with you about that.
Blimey, somebody put that down in writing. We just agreed.
No, no, we're on the same team.
Well.
Yeah, we are. We're partners.
Is there an end in sight? Do you think all the deadlines Britain set itself, it will meet, Peter?
Well, there's Article 50. I think it's about another 40 months, and then it's the end of this and a beginning of a new and mature relationship with Europe.
Is it, though? Is it only going to take that? I mean, it took Greenland 3 years, didn't it? All they had to talk about was fish. And we've got fish and chips.
It's one thing, but, I mean, it's all going, as far as I can see, quite according to plan. We're moving on to the second stage of the negotiations. And then we'll sort out a deal and nothing much will change, actually. But what we will have got back is something which, in Europe, they don't have, is the ability to run your own country, unelected bureaucrats. And...
the next question from the lady in the red hat. Lucy, do you...
It's all the sort of emotional argument about what we're going to get. Like Philip Hammond said this week, he said, he criticised the silence from the EU about what kind of relationship they want with the UK after Brexit. And you go, well, yeah, of course there's silence. It's because they literally don't care. I mean, it is like, you know, when you finish a relationship and, you know, you text and say, you're still thinking about me, and you get the text back, sorry, new phone, who's this? They're very happy for us to just die by our own hand. I mean, I find it...
Sorry, this is, again, this lack of perspective I find so odd on this. You die by your own hand. You know, excuse me, we'll carry on. We're still going to be in the same place, except that we'll have parliamentary...
Oh, God, that's a relief. I genuinely thought we were... You are putting so many minds at rest. I really...
You know, we're going to die.
I thought we're going to have to build a propeller and stick it on.
It's probably one of those metaphors people talk about.
massacres and...
I brought my Japanese sword and everything.
We're not going to join Japan, don't worry. We're going to have a perfect trade relationship with Japan.
I have been enjoying the Brexit metaphors. Hammond this week said it takes two to tango, which I thought that's not a very British, you know, that's not British enough. It should be it takes six to Morris dance. Or maybe nine to do a drunken conga at a wedding. Yeah, no.
This is Philip Hammond and David Davis and their optimistically titled EU Charm Offensive. Philip Hammond complained that the EU had given no indication of how they want to go forward, and he's right, it's ridiculous. Makes you wonder why the EU held this referendum in the first place. It's Hammond's first trip to Germany since his stag do in Frankfurt. Touchdown on Terra Germania at 2 p.m, check-in at the hostel, couple of pints of potato salad, rickshaw to the financial district. Phil had to bail out of the tour at Deutsche Bank early, mind utterly blown. The EU
are taking a robust line on negotiations around financial services. Banking jobs are incredibly important to the UK economy. Last year, the banking sector contributed £24.4 billion to UK tax receipts, mostly through bar takings at the Slug and Lettuce and sales of pink ties from TM Lewin. That's before we even consider the apology bouquets bought from petrol stations. Or the cocaine. David Davis remains confident of achieving a tariff-free deal, but is he the right man for the job? He does, after all, look like a drunk businessman who sits down next to you on a train, gets out his phone and starts showing you nude pictures of his wife, demanding you rate them out of 10, then punches you, vomits, tries to kiss the train guard, before quietly getting off at Chepstow. 2 points to Peter. Lucy, who's no longer prepared to carry on?
Ah, yes. This is Carrie Gracie, who has resigned as the BBC's China editor. And although she hasn't left the BBC, she didn't want to leave. They didn't want to sack her. Instead, they punished her by making her present the Today programme with John Humphreys. she resigned because she discovered that she was being paid significantly less than other international editors because they had different skill sets, they had kind of different attributes, that they were men. They were men, that was it.
I really liked the fact that she wrote an open letter. You know, like, if you've had an open letter written about you, that is bad news. It's the literary equivalent of someone spray-painting a penis on the side of your house.
The issue about pay at the BBC is the difference between the stonking money, 400 grand for John Humphreys a year, and the average producer, 25 grand. There's huge difference between working people who really have to struggle, particularly in central London and Manchester, and the big fat cats at the top. And when we learnt last summer that the BBC was paying these gigantic salaries, John Sopel in Washington, 220k a year, once again, more than Kim Darroch. I know that the BBC reporter in Washington is more important than the British ambassador in Washington. I realise that. But it's both publicly funded money, licence fee payers' money. And this is a great big narrative about very rich and privileged people being paid even more money. It makes Daily Mail readers furious.
Well, finally, we found what does it.
I wondered, as women, whether we should make a stand, whether me and Kathy and Angela, maybe we should leave the programme now.
Don't leave me with Peter.
I think it would be a powerful statement if we got to the pub half an hour before. Well, it would be a lovely comment on the value of female labour, and it would mean that I could get out of paying my babysitter for an extra 2 hours, so that'd be good. But I mean, obviously, you can debate whether people should be paid more or less globally, but I think of all the people who are qualified for a job, she speaks fluent Mandarin and she is facing a sort of repressive state machine, you know, and maybe it should be on a sliding scale. Maybe, you know, you're the China editor, you get paid a lot of money. I don't know who the editor for the Bahamas is, but they get national minimum wage, as far as I'm concerned. I still get this sense sometimes that people think when you're a woman that you're not the main household income. So, you know, there's still that kind of hangover that it's like, oh, you've got a little job, that's lovely. So you're probably spending the money on hatpins and bobbins and rouge, lovely, you know. Luckily, on the news quiz, we're all paid exactly the same. I know that for a fact, because we've checked. And it's nearly enough for my whole bus fare.
This is the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie, who has resigned after finding out two male international editors are paid 50% more than her. But in fairness, like all male media executives, they will need that money when they're eventually brought to justice. Gracie presented the Today programme the day after her departure was announced, which was uncomfortable for her co-host, John Humphreys, or would have been if he didn't find gender inequality and indeed discrimination of all kind absolutely hilarious. The news led to a classic case of the BBC tying itself up in knots, with the BBC's Evan Davies on the BBC's Newsnight saying, "We did ask to speak to the BBC today, but nobody was available." He then lifted a small mirror to his face and saw no reflection. Points to Lucy. And at the end of round one, the scores are Angela and Peter have 4, and so too Deloitte and Lucy. We start round two with a cutting from the Metro.
A football supporter whose team have not won at home for almost a year was arrested after pulling his pants down during a match. Fellow Sunderland fan said the teenager defecated on his seat during a 3-1 defeat to Reading at the Stadium of Light. A club spokesman said the matter was in the hands of the Northumbria police.
Our thanks to Chris Cavey in Hebden Bridge and Eileen Scholes in Gosport for sending us that. Angela, who's got bags of good ideas?
Theresa May has outlined the government's plans for a green future. She plans to scrap avoidable waste by 2042. The Lib Dems are pissed off because 2042 was the year they had earmarked for their comeback. So, some of the things that she outlined is she wants to now charge 5p for plastic bags in smaller shops as well as just the larger shops. So now we get to pay for those little blue plastic bags of shame at the late night off licence. That's
nice that she's planning 25 years ahead, because in her position I wouldn't be planning 25 minutes ahead.
I suppose it's that far ahead. It's a kind of, you can announce a policy like with a slight air of relief. You know, you can say what you like on the basis that you'll be long gone by the time this goes wrong. I'm not saying that's a sort of classic baby boomer strategy, but there's a, slight element. How do you feel, Peter?
Like this is a visionary moment where it's a very serious problem, plastic in the oceans. We all know it is. I would say that Daily Mail has been campaigning on this for 10 years. It's a great triumph for our campaigning, and I feel very proud to have been part of that.
I think the Daily Mail really cared about the environment. There's a really good way they could save paper.
You can't, this is on the radio, so you can't. She's sitting next to me. She's on my team. What the hell do I have to put up with?
It's nice. We're all watching a beautiful thing, Peter.
Packaging thing is definitely a problem. It's absurd the amount of packaging that we use. See, I think about the coconuts being packaged in plastic, like they haven't got their own packaging. You know, that's insane. This, oh, it stops the coconuts from going off. What are you talking about? I don't want to stop coconuts from going off. You know what happens when a coconut goes off? Malibu.
I bought one of those plastic-covered coconuts for my friend's baby daughter. It's completely bald and full of milk. But enough about my friend's baby daughter.
This is the government's new environmental plan, aiming to eradicate avoidable plastic waste from the UK by 2040. Labour have said this is a cynical PR exercise, but it's actually so the Conservatives can protect plastic bags for their traditional and rightful purpose, namely autoerotic asphyxiation. Of fun. I mean, it all sounds very noble, but if it means we could sign a trade deal with the US, I'm fairly sure the government would have us all drinking liquid lead out of a hollowed out polystyrene swastika. We can all do more. Think of how many people simply leave their old refrigerators in the street rather than taking the trouble to dump them in a river. My whole attitude to these things changed when I saw a photo of a duck with its head stuck in a plastic bottle. It was absolutely hilarious. Asked about her own environmental credentials, Theresa May said that she'd put up bat boxes in her garden, presumably in the hope that she could finally coax them out of her bedroom. Fly, my British! Two points to Angela. Peter, heavy is the head that wears the what?
Well, that could possibly be a reference to the crown, which, of course, is a remark made by Her Majesty the Queen this week, to the effect that I think she found the coronation quite tough going, particularly the crown on her head. Most people go through a bit of a traumatic experience and they're talking about it and they're on social media. It's taken the Queen 65 years to say it was actually quite hard going at the coronation.
To be fair, I don't think they had Twitter in 1950.
That's an interesting point.
It's kind of one of those problems, I suppose, that, like a coronation, even if it's a bit of a nightmare, you've only got to go through it the once, haven't you? Unless you lose and win a succession of civil wars. But, Well, I think even if that was the political atmosphere, the coronations would get rather less showy with each successive...
with each successive one.
Yeah. That, just... weddings, you know, by the time you're on your third one, it's like you have to grab the witnesses off the street.
I did that once. I was someone's witness at a wedding. I'd gone to Camden Town Hall, and a lady came up to me in the street and went, "Are you busy? Are you doing anything?" And I went, "No." And she went, "Come to my wedding." And I went in and...
And now you're married.
Yes. I just... Yeah, she told me where to stand, told me what to say, told me how much I loved her. And there was me and like one of the building servitors. We were the witnesses, and it was about a 15-minute ceremony. And I would say this, as someone about to enter an endurance event called Tough Guy, when the registrar said that they are married, I was comfortably the most emotional person in the room. I thought it was lovely. I really did. I thought it was genuinely lovely. At my coronation, I will just lose it. It's going to be so big, it's going to be so... The way you're all going to be clapping and applauding, it's going to be hard for me. Anyone know what was so upsetting then? What was difficult about the journey for Her Majesty?
She was in a 18th-century golden coach, and apparently the suspension on those isn't great. I'm not a historian myself, but I have other facts about things from the 18th century. Spinning jennies, quite fiddly. The guillotine really chafes.
This is a new documentary about the Queen's coronation, in which Her Majesty reveals that travelling in the royal carriage was horrible and that her coronation crown had disadvantages due to its weight. The Queen might complain about the heavy crown, but it's given her the most muscular neck in her cage-fighting weight division. Her Majesty has to go around in a gold carriage, of course, because of her terrible Uber rating. one star she has, which is what happens when your corgi craps in a footwell. And if she thinks her crown was uncomfortable, she's clearly never been on a hen night, as I have, in a Claire's Accessories tiara. I write all the jokes, Peter.
I was worrying about that. Is there such a thing as a right-wing scriptwriter at the BBC?
Listen, you just write the address. It's Biddy Baxter, care of BBC Television Centre. 2 points, Peter. Lloyd, have a listen to this. Well, Lloyd, who claimed to be taking up more space?
This is a Japanese astronaut by the name of Norishige Kanai, and he claimed that he grew an extra 9 centimetres once aboard the International Space Station, which is sort of like the Big Brother house for space nerds. And on hearing the news, Tom Cruise hurriedly booked tickets to visit. I don't know if you're aware of this, Miles, but...
Almost certainly not.
You grow taller when you go into space, right, because the lack of gravity allows the vertebrae in your spine to grow apart. There's a very famous phrase to help you remember it. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, but absence of gravity makes the spine go longer. Oh.
This is one that they'd teach you on the training, I suppose.
No, it's Isaac Newton's first theorem, actually.
Oh, right, and what does that rhyme with?
But it turned out that the Japanese astronaut measured himself incorrectly and then posted about it on Twitter.
Maybe he's just, like, not a science guy.
I think of all the things you could measure incorrectly and then post about on Twitter, he probably got away lightly. And he'd only grown 2 centimetres rather than 9. He was really excited and giddy, and there was a sort of senior Russian astronaut who sort of went, "Chill out, mate. You wouldn't grow 9 centimetres. He was worried because the shuttle that they used to get up and down... I'm not an expert in this. Unlike the army... the Soyuz the Soyuz space capsule has a height limit. It's like the opposite of a roller coaster. If you're too tall, you can't ride. So this Japanese astronaut, he was worried he was going to have to be stuck in space.
Everyone said he was tweeting about, you know, getting taller to show off. It's like, you don't need to tweet about getting... You're an astronaut. You had us an astronaut.
Do you think, is that not part of the... You know, the Japanese astronaut training doesn't involve how to use a ruler. That's...
You can't play... What's that old joke my dad used to say, you know, about... that's why men are better at reading maps than women. It's only they can understand the concept of 2 centimetres equaling a mile.
This is the story of Japanese astronaut Norishige Kanai, who claimed to have grown 9 centimetres in his first few weeks aboard the International Space Station, before realising he had, in fact, only grown 2 centimetres. The first time you realise that being in space can quickly make your legs longer is the way that Neil Armstrong did one small step and then a giant leap. Although Kanai now admits he didn't grow by 9 centimetres during his space travels, he still insists he did lose his virginity to a sexy lady astronaut. You wouldn't know her, she goes to another space station. Kanai was previously an officer in the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, so he can't use a tape measure correctly, but should it be needed aboard the ISS, he can beat the absolute crap out of a sea lion. You wonder why he's spending his time measuring himself, but it must be quite boring in space. At least the Russian cosmonauts get regular phone calls from Putin asking, is the laser ready yet? We don't know what Tim Peake makes of all this, but no doubt he'll tell us. 2 points to Lloyd. Lucy, who's not cut out for the job?
This is the Prime Minister of Thailand, who this week replaced himself at a press conference with a cardboard cutout. which obviously would never work over here, because if Theresa May did it, everyone would say, why is she suddenly so warm and approachable? so he didn't want to talk to reporters. He's got this guy, so Prayut Kanocha is the guy who seized power in a military coup in 2014 and then kept saying there was going to be an election and then pushing it back and back and back. Very much the opposite of Theresa May, really. And he doesn't really like the press so far. He's thrown a banana peel at a cameraman. He threatened to hit someone with his podium and pulled a reporter along by the ear. So at least with the cardboard cutout, the only injury you're going to get is a paper cut. So he doesn't like the press and he just went, right, that's it, I'm not going to talk to them. So it wouldn't devastate me if more politicians didn't just stick something else out instead of themselves. I was thinking, Tim Farron, you could just have, like, you know those signs that you get outside shops that spin round in the wind and one side would say gay sex isn't a sin and the other one would go, yes, it is. Donald Trump, just a golf sale sign, I presume. I don't know. If I wanted a cardboard cutout of myself, it'd be quite cheap because I fit on a sheet of A3.
But also, it'd be hard for a British politician. The way the whole political system operates, they'd need 2 cardboard cutouts, wouldn't they? Because they'd have to have one of them in a suit and then one of them wearing a high-vis jacket and a builder's hat. So it's the 2 states in which politicians are allowed to be seen.
And a cardboard wife and children saying that everything's OK in the marriage.
And then this cardboard sex worker. It's brilliant.
Very kinky, a couple of staples.
You a fan of this Thai Prime Minister, Peter?
Well, at least you know where you stand with him.
Yeah. That's right. He's not wishy-washy, is he? He's
no. Kind of
racist.
You're on the same team as me. What are you trying to get at?
I don't mean wishy-washy as in, like, the pantomime. You can't turn on everyone tonight, Angela.
I don't know what's got my back up.
These are the antics, and it's not a word I use lightly, of Prime Minister of Thailand Prayut Chan-o-cha, who told Thai media this week that they were to address all questions about politics to a cardboard cutout of himself. Observers now expect the cardboard cutout to seize power, leading Thailand in a 10-year reign of terror before somehow ending up in a student halls in Cardiff in a rowing club T-shirt and a Guinness hat. There are, of course, plenty of precedents for this. During the Suez crisis, Anthony Eden passed all media inquiries to a glove puppet called Mr. Sausages. Later, of course, Lord Sausages. Donald Trump has already had a 10-minute phone conversation with the cardboard cutout and said that he is a great guy, a real... at last, a listener. Personally, I think cardboard people should not get ideas above their station and stick to standing in the window of Jessop's offering deals on passport photos, a job at which they undeniably excel. This will be revolutionary, of course, on the world leader circuit. Next year's G8 will just be a selection of cutout scarecrows and mannequins and Theresa May saying, I think Brexit can work for all of us. 2 points to Lucy. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they would like to share? Peter.
Yeah, Liam Brown of Wilberforce was just come back from Singapore, where he saw a temporary shop front saying, the world's oldest barbershop, opening December 2017.
Lloyd.
Mike Cox and E.J. E. Brown saw this in the corrections and clarifications section of The Guardian. A review of Peggy Seeger's memoir quotes her description of her early impressions of Ewan McCall and how they fell in love, saying he had a hairy, fat, naked belly poking out and was clad in ill-fitting trousers, suspenders, no shirt, a ragged jacket and a filthy lid of a stovepipe hat aslant like a garbage can. The context we omitted was that McCall was appearing in a production of the Threepenny Opera.
Thank you. Now let's take a look at the final score. Angela and Peter have 10, but this week's winners are Lloyd and Lucy with 11. Before we leave you, here is a headline spotted on the BBC Sport website, sent in by Chris Giles in Gosport.
23-year-old jockey Willie Twiston Davis retires to focus on breeding.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Angela Barnes, Peter O'Born, Lloyd Langford and Lucy Porter. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Cathy Clubston. The chair script was written by Madeline Bressingham, James Kettle and Benjamin Partridge, with additional material by Laura Major, Mike Shepherd and Katie Story. The producer was Richard Morris and it was a BBC Studios production.